Brian. Good evening, everybody. How are you tonight? Very glad to have you aboard the latest episode of Talking Hoosier Baseball. We are a podcast brought to you by the IUBase.com website for anyone looking for more information on the Indiana University baseball program. Today is January 14th, the year 2019. I am Chris Feeney, and I am also here with our stat guru, Cassidy Palmer, the king of the RPI. There is nobody better, Carl James, and our resident baseball mind and the creator of IUBase.com, Josh Bennett. All right, so it's 32 days to go till opening day, and I know we're all in season preview mode. We're all ready for that February 15th opening day game in Memphis. You know, we're wondering who's pitching on Friday, who's pitching on Saturday, how good is Tanner Gordon, is Matt Lloyd really playing third, who's playing right, how many shifts is Mercer going to use, what freshmen are making the team. It's all valid, but we're going to put it all on hold for today, because we got a special guest. He comes to us from the world champion Boston Red Sox organization. He is a five-year Hoosier baseball alum. He is a back-to-back Big Ten tournament and regular season champion. He was on the 2013 College World Series team. Sit back and relax. Grab some Skyline. We got Kyle Hart. Kyle, first off, thanks for joining us. I know you're a real busy guy in the offseason. Thanks for giving us some time.
Oh, thank you, guys. I love the Skyline tidbit, too. I will be 100% honest with this whole process, and the first thing I have to be honest is that I just had five cheese cones about an hour ago. So that's a perfect add-in because I've been absolutely crushing some Skyline. But thank you. Seriously, no, I'll talk Hoosier baseball. I'll talk any kind of baseball as long as anybody will listen to me. So appreciate you guys having me on. And just like everybody else listening, I am fired up to get these Hoosiers started off. And it's pretty amazing, too, because they get to start a little bit earlier than us. So it's kind of like bonus baseball for me, so to speak, once they get going.
So so Kyle wore number 14 for the Hoosiers, but he comes in much higher than that in a lot of spots in the IU record books. He is second in career wins, career innings pitched, career Big Ten wins, and career Big Ten strikeouts. He's third in career Big Ten innings pitched, fourth in career strikeouts, and 10th in career Big Ten ERA. Over his career, Kyle had a 2.87 ERA with a 17% strikeout rate compared to a 6% walk rate. He also threw three complete games, two of them in his senior year alone. Speaking of that senior year where he paced the Big Ten with 10 wins, Kyle posted a 3.29 ERA, but it was just 1.93 at the BART. And he had a 4% walk rate and a 20% strikeout rate. And he threw, these are some of my own stats, so they are a little wishy-washy listening on the radio, but threw about 67% of his pitches for strikes and threw a first pitch strike to about 70% of the batters he faced. So far in professional baseball, Kyle has a 2.9 ERA in 267 and a third innings of work across 50 games, has a whip of 1.26, and has maintained his strikeouts at a 20% rate. He also tossed his first pro complete game in a seven-inning shutout in August of last year.
Kyle, you were the student athlete representative on the search committee that hired Chris Lemonis after Skip left for Arizona State. The IU program just went through a coaching transition. Again, that was a lot of responsibility to put on your shoulders. Must have been a bit of a shock. How did you handle that whole process?
So I actually believe that might have been the first or second year that Fred Glass had implemented the student athlete bill of rights. I don't recall. I think it was the first year because I got a call a couple days after Tracy had chosen to depart, and they were like, "Hey, you're the student athlete we've chosen to be on the search committee." And I was like, "What?" You know, I wasn't really the eldest member you know, on the team by any stretch. There was, you know, we still had Halstead, Nolden. We still had several guys older than me. But I mean, they were brought in a little bit too, but they, you know, they kind of have to declare somebody. Just, I don't know if that's kind of red tape or whatever, but they had to declare a student athlete. They chose me. It was very interesting because as athletes, we didn't see that side of the athletic department at all. You know, we showed up to the field. We knew what the practice schedule was. We knew what we had to do to get better throughout the year. And we knew our, you know, our competition schedule and travel schedule and all that, but we had no idea, you know, of the inner workings. At least I didn't, until that all kind of went down. And one of the most interesting aspects of it was happening so fast because, you know, Tracy left obviously after the season, and then you had a lot of recruits kind of in limbo, you know, Laren Eustace, the Logan Sowers, those type of guys, Chris Lowe, that we really, really needed and we were counting on getting. And, you know, when a coach leaves, it opens up that door for those guys to be flexible with their decisions, and, you know, rightfully so. And so that was their whole thing. We want to get this done fast. We want to get this done really fast. We have a ton of qualified candidates. I don't remember the exact number, but I remember asking Roger Rodehaver, I believe, was, how many applicants did you guys have? And in the first week, there was like 2,200 or something. I mean, maybe Raj, we have to get into contact with him. Maybe he remembers that number, but it was something obscene to where like high school dads were sending in applications for it and stuff. And I was like, oh my God, how are you guys sorting through all this? So for this to go down as fast as it did was amazing in itself. I remember the final two candidates were Coach Lemonis and then Coach Maloney, who was over in Ball State. And we all kind of liked both of them. And I remember going to the team and going to Will Nolden and Halstead and Hartong and saying, you know, who do you guys like? And everyone was really split, actually. We had a lot of respect for both guys. And obviously they went with Coach Lemonis, who did a great job. And I think ultimately what they wanted, somebody a little younger, maybe somebody they could start fresh with. And, you know, I personally saw Coach Maloney from Ball State as an extension of Tracy. He just seemed like such a similar coach to Tracy Smith for me. And I think that consistency was something some guys were interested in. And then some guys were interested in Coach Simonis. And by all means, I think they made the right choice, but the interviews themselves were pretty amazing. It was all phone interview because I was out of Bloomington, and yeah, it was pretty overwhelming. The first couple, I think I did three, and yeah, it was a little bit overwhelming, honestly, just being in a process like that where people's livelihoods are at stake. You know, it's much bigger than just showing up to the field and playing every day. You're talking about moving families, and you're talking about large dollar amounts and just things that those weren't capacities that I was dealing with each and every day.
So, you know, one follow-up question on that is, what advice would you give to the current players that are going through a coaching change right now? What would you tell them?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, I would tell them to as much as they can immediately pour your trust into the coaching staff. I mean, that's all you can do, because at the end of the day, you know, if you don't have the trust, you know, as a two-way street between the coaches and the players, you're not going to get anywhere. Whether you have the most talented players or the most knowledgeable coaches, it doesn't matter. So that's what I felt like really set us over the edge with both of our coaches was ultimately being able to trust each other. And I felt like those last couple of years with Tracy, he just let us do our thing. And he knew what he was going to get in return. He knew what product was going to get put out on that field. And honestly, his last several games in both years, he didn't really have to do a whole lot of coaching, and he'll tell you that. And I think we got to that point with Coach Lemonis too, especially the older guys, you know. And so, you know, obviously Coach Mercer is more than qualified to coach any team in the country. And from what I hear and from what I've seen so far from him and from people around the program, he's going to be pretty amazing. So I think trust is the biggest thing that needs to be developed early on. And obviously, you know, that last little bit of trust isn't going to kind of fully come to fruition until the season starts and we see what we have. But, you know, if from what I hear, they're getting it pretty quickly.
Yeah, so Kyle, you were a 5-year out-of-state student athlete in a sport with a low scholarship cap and now have several years in the minor leagues where it pays low, to put it nicely. How has that experience molded your opinion on how athletes at those levels are compensated, and maybe give us your thoughts as to what can be done to make it a little easier for individuals in your situation?
So that's another good question. Yeah, I have an opinion on this. I don't feel as strongly about it as some other guys do. Trust me, a lot of guys across the board would spill their mind on this right away. I believe that in my lifetime, I don't think while I'm still playing, but in my lifetime, there will be a change. There will be an overhaul in terms of compensation, not only for student athletes, but for professionals that aren't at the top of their sport, minor league hockey, minor league baseball, the D league, you know, obviously NFL practice squad and reserve squad have a little bit better of a structure, but still that could probably even improve a little bit from what I understand. So I think in our lifetime, that will change, you know, we're to the point that minor league players are making $3,000-$5,000 a month. And I do think that college athletes at some point are going to have to be paid. Not so much because it's my opinion that they should be, but because I think people are starting to realize what the dollar amounts actually are, what some of these universities are actually sitting on, and then people are starting to uncover some of the stuff that's going on in the NCAA in terms of you know, who's in bed with who. And people are just following the money, and they understand, you know, how much money is actually coming in. And so like I said, I don't know the solution so much for the NCAA. I used to have arguments all the time about this, because then you get into, well, the football team is bringing in more money at an Alabama type school, so they should get more. Well, then how does Title IX come in? You know, how do those things kind of play in? But I do believe that, personally, I would like to see a performance-based payment of some kind. Now, how you justify that and, you know, intertwine that with the integrity of the game not dwindling, that's another story, okay? And you know, I see people's argument with that whole thing, but I really do believe that we're gonna be looking at a, you know, redivision here of the money. And then in terms of professional baseball, yeah, it's a little bit criminal what's happening, but again, you kind of have to put that in the back of your mind, or it's going to affect your job performance. My camera keeps going out here, but anyway, you know, there's guys that really care, and those are the guys, and I understand, because the guys that have families, the guys that are married and have a couple kids now, and you know, that's not enough money to even consider, you know, a college fund or anything like that for your kids. You're basically, you have enough money to live, pay rent and eat. And so that's where the restructure probably needs to happen is, you know, at least minimum wage. I mean, that's all we're really asking for at the end of the day. Can we just get minimum wage? You know, because if you paid us minimum wage at the hours that we're working, you know, 6 days a week, 7 days a week, a lot of weeks, we could save some money. And to the point where I wouldn't be so worried about, you know, getting released or having to hang up my cleats, because I know I have a little bit of money that I could at least move forward on to get my own apartment, to have some time to find a job, you know. But right now, that's the biggest problem, is you can't save any money. You're spending it all on rent. Whatever you don't spend on rent, you might eat out once a week. And in terms of like things I like to do, golf, fish, some weeks you don't have money for entertainment like that. So, you know, I'm hopeful. I really am hopeful, but I'm not counting on anything. Certainly in the next few years, you can start to see the sparring going on, between two, you know, some different groups of people. You see people trying to go after the NCAA. You see people trying to get more representation for minor league players, maybe a better representation in the Players Association of some kind. But what would end up having to happen is it would have to get siphoned off the top, most likely. And that's where it comes in. Like, do those major league guys, a lot of them who grinded out the minor leagues to get that money, do they want to give money back to the system that they just had to beat. You know what I mean? So that's you know, that's where it would have to come from, probably. But again, that's all hearsay. That's all my opinion, and you know, we'll see. I'm not counting on it, certainly.
I really appreciate your honesty, Kyle. A lot of people don't look at that aspect of professional baseball. You know, it's just, you know, MLB is professional baseball. No, MLB is the top of the top. There's plenty of great professional baseball going on in the minor leagues, and I really don't think you guys are getting compensated right either. Just to stick with minor league baseball, could you touch on a couple of the differences between the minors and your college days as far as the competition and preparation and stuff?
Well, if we have time later, too, we should talk about the whole Kyler Murray thing, because that's so in line with what you just asked me, and it's kind of crazy to think about what he's doing. I mean, I think he just declared, correct me if I'm wrong, for the NFL draft a few hours ago, right?
Correct.
But
trying to groundbreaking move with the money,
yeah,
from Mike.
I don't blame him. I think if he would have been around $10 million, I think they might have given it to him. I think they were really close. But anyway, just to come back to that if we have a few minutes.
Yep.
There's definitely differences in minor league baseball. Some better, some worse. Most of them are better. I mean, you get to play baseball every single day. You don't have to go to school. You wake up, you go to the park, and there's an opposing team every single night that has a ton of talented guys. My first couple years, I was in extended spring training. Low A, high A, finally had a full season of double A last year, which was really nice to just know that I was, you know, getting to some of these higher levels and I was going to be kind of a staple there throughout the course of the year. Instead of the last, you know, the year before, I was in three different levels, you know, was very unstable in terms of just having a consistent job. I mean, I was moving around. Luckily, I was moving in the right direction, but, you know, you never know in this game. The biggest difference is the talent, obviously. I mean, especially last year in Double A, the Eastern League is absolutely loaded. You're talking about Vlad Jr., Brendan Rodgers, Dante Bichette's son, Bo Bichette, Kevin Biggio, just absolute beasts. That, you know, you look at those guys, you face them every other night, and you're like, yeah, those are the future guys of the major leagues. I need to get these guys out now, because if I make it to the big leagues, I'm going to be facing them, you know, and you have to come to terms with the fact that you're never going to be the most talented on the field. You're never going to be the smartest baseball IQ person on the field. You're not going to be the biggest or strong, any of that. So, you know, those are the things that, you know, you start to understand, you start to see. The one thing I dislike about professional baseball that I didn't deal with in college was the team aspect. Don't get me wrong, you get on a lot of really good teams, and professional baseball is loaded with great guys. But, you know, if we're down four runs in the seventh inning or five runs, everyone's just kind of kicking back, like trying to put a good swing on the ball. No one's really thinking, like, we got to get bases loaded here and try to hit a couple doubles. Like, you know, when it comes down to it, everyone is trying to win, but the team aspect of like picking each other up, it's not quite there. It's not quite the same. You know, I'm not saying everyone's just screwing off in the, you know, in the dugout. That's not going on, but you know, you don't quite feel the absolute unquenchable thirst to win every single game. That's probably the best way I can put it, in professional baseball versus college baseball, where it was just desperation all the time. You know, down one in the third inning in a Saturday game, it was like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, you know. And I think that just comes back to you play so many games, and you just kind of chill out in terms of just your emotion, your adrenaline. You know, you just kind of mellow out. And I don't think that means you're not trying as hard, but, you know, everything just kind of gets toned back a little bit emotionally. And then the amenities are nicer. I mean, you stay at some nice hotels, you ride nice buses, people pack your bags up and stuff like that. Just little things like that don't really make or break the game for me. But as you go up, you start to see things gradually improve. You know, the food gets better. The clubhouse guys are willing to do a lot more for you. And then obviously in the big leagues, it's just the absolute life every single day. So, you know, I've started to see some of this paying off in terms of just enjoying the game more as you go up and up and up. And I'm just hoping that, I can kind of continue the path I'm on in terms of just progressing through the system.
It's been great. It's been great watching you advance, man. It really has. All-star this year for Portland. I'm sure you were playing in that all-star game amongst a lot of those guys you just mentioned up against those beasts. So as far as your prep for next year, can you talk a little bit about your routine? I know this is, what, your third or fourth professional season?
This will be my third full year. Yep. So okay. So my fourth year technically, but nobody counts that first year you're drafted as a full
okay.
year.
Okay, I wasn't sure.
Such a knick-knack thing, but that's how people.
Yep.
That's how people would say it. Yeah, I'm in my third full year.
Your third. So do you have a full routine down? Do you have something that works? Or what are you doing on your off season?
You mean an off season? Yeah. So right now I was mainly focused on just weight gain for me. Just trying to put some muscle on. Obviously, this is pretty much true for everybody, especially the position players. You lose some weight during the season. So like for me, I got to like 210 pounds last off season. And I finished the year at about 199. So that's a little bit more than I would like it. Like I didn't do a great job at the end of the year of really trying to maintain my weight and strength, which is, you know, that's something that I've obviously already established as a goal for me. But, you know, I just try to put on as much muscle mass as I can going into the season, into spring training, knowing that, you know, just all the running, all the heat of spring training, and then a full season is going to knock you back just a little bit. So that was my main goal. I was lifting 4 days a week, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. And then as of probably 2 weeks ago, start throwing. And then bullpen started for me 2 days ago. So just really light bullpens because I go down to Florida February 3rd, I'll be down in Florida just getting physicals and stuff like that. And then I have 10 or 14 days or something until pitchers and catchers report. But everyone kind of likes to get down there early just to get your feet under you, get acclimated to the climate. It's 19 here tonight. So it's like, you know, you're trying to get used to that warm weather. And it's good for your arm too, to get down there early because you don't want to have to jump into those major league spring training games and not have an arm that's in shape, you know, especially if you get lucky enough to pitch the first five innings and, you know, Machado or Trumbo standing in front of you and you're like, okay, my arm's not in shape. I feel good. And obviously a lot of guys do this too, but I have a physical therapy clinic up here that I go twice a week and just get maintenance, do a lot of my arm care and shoulder stuff that I think helps. I haven't done that in the past. I just started it this year and it's probably something I'm going to keep doing. Because it's really had an impact on just how my arms felt as I started throwing.
So looking back at your time as a Hoosier, what was kind of your favorite moment while at IU? What kind of sticks out?
So off the top of my head, my best moments were not on the field. Just there's so many that, you know, that had nothing to do with baseball. And that's why I love IU so much. That's why I wear this jacket almost every day because it just changed my life. I mean, you know, just being with all those guys, meeting new people on campus. I mean, if I could make enough money to just sustain myself as a college athlete for my entire life and they would let me do it, I would have done it because it's the most fun, the most carefree. I mean, we had plenty of responsibilities, but, you know, moving forward into, you know, even professional baseball and what sliver of real life that is, you didn't have any real responsibilities in college unless like some people you had to work to pay your tuition and stuff like that. But you know, when you really break it down, it was just such a stress-free way of living life and so enjoyable at IU. And then on top of that, we were lucky to just have some absolute dominant teams. And as you guys know, you don't have dominant teams unless you just have unbelievable chemistry, brotherhood, companionship. So like I said, some of my favorite moments were just eating with the guys, going back after, you know, on spring break and winter break and fall break and meeting some of these guys' families, eating with them, staying with them, going to their weddings after school. But in terms of baseball for me, you know, the big moments were the best ones. I mean, Chad Clark's walk-off was pretty incredible. And I remember that like it was yesterday because I was in the bullpen when he made the errors and, you know, hugely affected the game for the worse. I went down to the dugout. Me and Scott Efrost were sitting there, and we sat there on the helmet rack. If you ever, I always look at that helmet rack, and it's like one of the most memorable places for me on IU's campus, because me and Scott Efrost sat on that helmet rack in the third base dugout, and we watched the inning unfold. You know, Casey Smith doubles. I think Basil hit a single or a double, and we get within a run or two, and me and Scott Efrost look at each other, and we look down the dugout, and Chad Clark is, you know, just staring out into the abyss, putting on his batting gloves. And I'm like, oh my God, Scott, we've got to get this kid to the plate. Just get this kid to the plate. And Scott looks at me, and was like, I was about to say the same thing. And he didn't say a word. I didn't say a word, and Chad Clark did not say a word. He walks over, he's got his batting gloves on. I think he had his leg guard on. He grabs his helmet, puts it on, and he goes on deck. And, you know, he's watching the inning too and realizing, hey, I might get a crack at this. And then he hits the home run. And me and Scott just kind of grabbed each other and looked and, you know, ran out to the field with everybody else. But that's just how baseball goes. You can feel those innings building. You know, a lot of times when somebody makes an error, they have that chance at redemption. Next time you guys watch a big league game, this happens so often. A big league player will make an insane defensive play, and then almost always they're like one of the first three batters up, and they'll get a hit or a big hit or a home run or something like that. It happens so often where it comes in waves like that. You know, it just baseball just comes in waves. When you're hot, you're hot. And that was the opposite example, where he had been the lowest of the low and the highest of the high. So that was a great one. Being with Schwarber when he was drafted was really awesome. Seeing him hit some of those home runs, him and Travis, DeMuth, Donnelly, just launching balls. I remember so many of their home runs. Schwarber hit a home run at Louisville, and I was just there the other day, and I looked up at that batter's eye, and he cleared that thing in the left field side of it by like 100 feet. And then, you know, the trip to the World Series, just the only thing I would have done if we could go back and do it different is just walk into Omaha like we were, like we belonged. I think that's the only thing we did wrong. And once the World Series was over, we realized that we should have won that thing. You know, we just showed up like so happy to be there, just knowing that we had already defied all the odds and everything. And maybe, you know, this is me speaking. Some other guys may have something different to say, but I was just so happy to be there, thinking that we were totally outmatched and outmanned. And that couldn't have been further from the truth. I mean, we were the best team there. And I didn't even play, so I'm somewhat unbiased in that perspective. But, you know, that trip was a treat. Just having your family come in and just being a celebrity for a few days in that town. And then, obviously, Tommy John and that whole process was really something that changed me for the better, although it was a horrible event, just to go through that and then come out of the other side kind of on top of my game and, you know, somewhat on top of the IU record books, well behind Joey Donato in most categories, but still, like I said, I mean, we don't have enough time to talk about all my favorite memories at IU.
Well, we here at Talking Hoosier Baseball, we each kind of have we've each picked out like kind of one game that we wanted to discuss.
Oh, please, yes.
So I'm going to start, and it kind of leads into just what you followed up with there, which is that for me, it was your first game back from after surgery, the 2-inning midweek start you had against Cincinnati, where you struck out 5 of the 8 that you faced. What was it like for you in that first game?
Well, I could be wrong, but I actually believe I threw one before that against Eastern Michigan. I think it was only one inning though, or was that after? I don't remember. But I threw a couple Cincinnati, Eastern Michigan, like really short, like 30 pitch outings. I remember the Cincinnati one being better. I didn't know I had struck out that. I never strike out guys like that. So yeah, I think probably I was just pitching with my fastball a little better, which usually leads to more strikeouts if you kind of have confidence in that pitch. But I remember that because that Ty Neal came back and was coaching that team, which was really cool to kind of get the pitch against the guy that recruited me. And then I remember one of the guys I did not get out was Ian Happ, who I threw a really good fastball to on the inside part, and he was just so strong even back then that he just kind of hooked it into left field. And I remember looking at him on second base and asking him, hey, was that pitch in? And he goes, yeah, I just got to it, man. I'm sorry. I'm like, you don't have to apologize. But Cincinnati, that was a grind, because I came back from that Tommy John and through those first few games and really did not feel well. Not a lot of people know this, but I really thought that I hurt my shoulder seriously after those first few games, those kind of rehab starts, and I had to shut it down. And I got into a little bit of a disagreement with Coach Bunn and Coach Lemonis, because I was like, guys, I can't lift my shoulder, and they're expecting me to keep pitching and to keep progressing. And I was like, I really can't. I need a few days. And they were frustrated because they had kind of had a timeline for me to come back. And then we sat down and finally hashed it out. And I was so appreciative to them, because they gave me about 10 days or 8 days or something. And they said, take as much time as you need. We need you healthy. And I went and did some physical therapy with my athletic trainer, and I kind of pushed through it. And it was just really scary to have this elbow thing, deal with it for 12 months, and then come back and have shoulder pain. I was like losing my mind. Those first couple starts were really crucial for me to kind of get to where I got to, you know, against the Maryland, against the Radford teams down the stretch. But I don't think if I'd have taken that break and kind of stepped back for a second, I'd have been in trouble.
Well, speaking of Radford, one of the most memorable moments that happened when you were on the mound.
Oh, I forgot about this. Come on, Kyle.
Was in your final start of your junior season, NCAA Regionals Game 1. Your final stat line ended up being outstanding with 7 innings pitched, 1 run, no walks, and 6 strikeouts. But kind of got off to an interesting start that had most of us on the edge, I think. The leadoff single followed by another single with the runner going first to third, and then you falling behind 3-0 to their 3-hole hitter. But we all know the magic that happened next, one of the craziest triple plays I've ever seen. But can you tell us your mindset in that moment of being before the triple play happened, 3-0, before you started to battle back? Just share your thoughts with us on that.
Well, you know, something that happened that day that's happened to me quite a few times is I couldn't get out of the gate. And I mean, I've said it in several interviews, especially in college, like for being a starting pitcher, I was an extremely slow starter. I had a lot of innings where I gave the other team the opportunity, whether it be pitches to hit or getting the other team ahead in the count by throwing balls. I gave them lots of opportunity. I can remember several times in my career. And I always said, if you're going to get to me, you're probably going to get to me in the first two innings. Whether it's me not being sharp or you guys just being ready to go. But I feel like once I get into those middle innings, that's when I get a little bit dangerous, because my pitch arsenal doesn't seem to have any real pattern. And before you know it, a lot of times it can be the fifth or sixth inning and you have one or two runs. And then at that point, I know what kind of offense that I had at IU. I know all I had to do was, you know, give us a chance. Because we were going to put runs up. But that particular game, I remember going 2-0, 3-0 on that guy, and I was like, oh, my God, I better just walk this kid. I mean, there's no point of giving up a double in the gap here. I grooved one 3-1, 3-0. I think he might have fouled one off on 3-1. And then I said this also in an interview prior, I knew we were in good shape when I lifted my leg to pitch the 3-2 ball. And I looked at first like I did a lot of times, and the runner was stationary. He wasn't moving. Because I was thinking about throwing a pickoff, and a lot of times I would lift my leg and kind of be in limbo there where do I want to pick or do I want to pitch? I kind of have the option, especially if I'm throwing a fastball. And he wasn't going. So then I turned my head to deliver the pitch, and I hear the dugout yell, runner, or going. And so in the back of my mind, like in a split second, I'm like, okay, this guy, if we throw a strike, this guy is hosed, because I just saw him not moving, and I know he's above average runner, but not a blazer. And luckily the pitch clipped the corner Evan Bell, you know, remember Evan Bell, the tall, lanky righty? He still argues to this day that that pitch was off the plate. I don't know if he's messing with me. I kind of think he is, but I went back and watched it like 100,000 times. It looks like a strike to me. But then, you know, Hartung gets the ball down in time for Ramos to just make an outstanding pick. And then I was like, okay, we just got two outs. And then I hear all this commotion, throw it home or whatever. And to see that kind of get started in front of you and then realize, oh crap, I have to go back up home and for a rundown, you know? But no, that's my point is that's probably the best moment of my athletic career in terms of just wildest play. And I didn't even remember it because of all the other memories that just drown out a lot of the time on the field. It kind of proves my point, but, And then, like I said, also in the interview, that just kind of set me up for the rest of the game of just what kind of, you know, what else do you want to have momentum going forward other than a freaking, what is that, a 1-2-6-2-5? He didn't throw it to Will Height. So that's just a two. One of you guys know better than I do what that was, but, yeah, I mean, just an amazing day and, you know, to get my first postseason win and to give us a chance at Vanderbilt was really exciting.
For me, Kyle, I chose, unfortunately, not a game that you won, but it really was, I thought, one of the better games still that I've seen at the Bart. And it was a Friday night against Illinois, 2016. Oh, yeah. You versus Sedlock, battling it out head-to-head. I mean, to watch you guys both being at the top of your craft for the whole night, man. It was really wild. And just looking at that game, maybe you could touch on, does it change your mentality when you're going against another stud, you know, another great pitcher?
So are you talking about back then or are you talking about in general, like including now, my mindset?
I would think in general, then or now.
So it actually has changed a little bit. But back then, yeah, back then I felt like I just felt like I had a little bit more responsibility because of just, you know, we have the scouting report. We know how good this guy is. We know how hard he throws. We know where he's probably going to go in the draft. So I feel like everyone's kind of anticipating a slow offensive game from our end. And it's my job to thwart the other team offensively as well. So, you know, yeah, you do. But the change in professional baseball is – everybody that runs out there on the mound is a stud. So it's the same thing every night. Whereas in college, you know, there was guys that were a lot more hittable, especially, you know, midweek or towards the back end of the weekend out of the bullpen. Like, you know, you have more opportunity to score some runs off some different guys, but it's like that in professional baseball too. But the difference is anybody out there is capable of throwing 7 or 8 shutout innings because most of them are throwing 93-95. But yeah, when I faced Sedlock, that was a very, very exciting game. It was towards the end of the year, I believe. It was the last regular season series, I believe, at home. So I knew that this was one of the last chances I had in front of a serious number of scouts, you know, because we didn't have any promise of the postseason at that point. So I knew, like, hey, you know, this might be your last chance besides the Big Ten tournament. And I felt like I put everything out there. I thought that was my best chance too, to maybe become a senior sign in that first 10 rounds and make just a little bit more money, which ended up almost happening, but fell through. Right. So, but it was such a treat to go up against him. Didn't he throw 10 innings that night or nine?
Yeah, he kept going. He made it into the 10th.
Yeah.
It was tied 1-1. You each gave up a run in a fourth.
I gave up a home run. Yeah. To that big righty. Yeah. I remember that pitch. It was just,
I think it was the only bad pitch you threw the whole night.
Yeah. And usually those get fouled off or something. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that one up too. That was really a treat to pitch against him. And I actually faced him too, or saw him pitch in pro ball in high A. I think he had some injuries he was dealing with, but still looked pretty good. So.
So I'm going to take a little bit of a different route with my favorite game. It was your senior year, that Game 3 against Purdue, which was interrupted by lightning with IU down. And then you end up going into center field when play resumes And IU ends up coming back to win 7-6. It was a crazy atmosphere, and it was just so much fun. So what was going through your mind when you went out into center field? How much lobbying did you have to do to go out and play center field?
So, wow, you guys are rattling off things that I didn't forget, but are just stored so deep down in my memory that I haven't rattled them off myself. But to answer your question, I was extremely excited, but the only reason I was a touch nervous was because I was just so physically checked out of the game. Mentally, I was there, you know, knew the situation, was rooting for our team as much as I could, just doing the normal things I do. And then I believe we had a substitution, and then Laren Eustace, we come out of the delay, and Laren Eustace pulled his hamstring, re-injured himself by slipping on first base. Mm-hmm. And after that substitution and that injury, Lemo was like, hey, we don't have an outfielder. And so he said, I didn't say anything. I wasn't like sitting there like looking at him like a hungry dog or anything. He just said to me, Kyle, go get your cleats on. And I didn't have any cleats on. He said, go get your cleats on. You're going to center. And well, not only did I not have my cleats on, I didn't have a glove in the dugout, which is pretty typical for a weekend pitcher to just not have anything, basically sunflower seeds and sunglasses. And I didn't have my jersey on underneath my jacket. I just had a t-shirt. So I had to run in and throw some cleats on. I was like, do I wear my metal cleats? Do I wear my molded cleats? Oh, it's raining. What, you know? So I put my jersey on, I ran straight from the clubhouse out to center field. And I remember throwing with Sowers in left or in right. And my arm was so sore. I didn't pitch that well that weekend against Purdue. I think we did win because we swept them, but I threw a lot of pitches and like labored through 5 or 6 innings. So I was just extremely sore. And it was also, that was the game, it was like 30 degrees and like sleeting. So that made my arm even more sore. So I was like, if I have to throw, we're in big trouble. And that's the other thing. Lemo told me, don't throw it. He's like, I'd rather just let them score than you like do something really bad. And I think the first batter that I saw hit a line drive right at me, which was just the baseball god saying, here you go, buddy. Welcome to the game. And then I specifically remember their big left-handed hitter. His name was it Kyle Wood, maybe? He was a big left-handed hitter, very good hitter, had a lot of power to his left center side, was facing Belcher and he was the go-ahead run. And Belcher got behind on him. And so, you know, Belcher has that natural run. So I'm thinking this guy's going to work to the left center gap being a left-hander. That's where he's been hitting him all weekend. You know, Coach Bunn had given me the scouting reports. And then when Belcher got behind on him, you know, I'd been in the left center gap. And when Belcher got behind, I shifted to the right center gap thinking this guy's going to try to take the lead right here. It's like 2-0 or 3-1 or something. And lo and behold, he drove one pretty well into the right center gap that I didn't have to really do anything crazy to get to. But had I been in the left center gap, you know, without the information that I had, I don't know if I would have got there. Maybe with a diving or jumping attempt, but it was that shift before the pitch that really helped me, which just kind of goes back to my youth of playing outfield. But the funniest part about that is I didn't have to lobby him because in that particular moment, I mean, because I lobbied him so much throughout the course of the year, just, hey, when am I going to get out there? When am I going to get out there? And so I was like that little fairy in the back of his mind. And by the time that he actually was, his back was up against the wall, he had no choice but to listen to that little voice in his head, which was me, because I had just been battering him for like 3 months. So I was very proud of myself. I think the other guys are more proud of me for just not screwing up and losing the game. But to sweep Purdue, whether I gotta fill the water cooler or go run down balls in center field, it's just a privilege every time.
Okay. I was just wondering about, you know, how you're now your teammates with ex-rivals, whether it's Maryland's Mike Schworn, and now you got to compete against him for promotions. And also when, you know, you might end up competing against former teammates for the same type of thing.
So, well, that's actually really funny because Mike is one of my really good friends on the team, which I don't know if it has anything to do with our Big Ten affiliations or not. I met him, you know, when we both got drafted. He took a little while to sign just over some financial disputes. And then, you know, we started playing together pretty consistently in my second year, which was last year in 2017, in Greenville. And then he gets promoted to Salem. And then a few weeks later, I got promoted to Salem. So we were kind of with each other most of 2017. And then we were with each other almost the entirety of 2018. He got moved up to AAA for about 3 weeks there at the end. But he is a real talent. Incredible to watch. We've learned a lot from each other. I actually was able to live with him the entire time we were in Salem, Greenville, and Portland. So I've lived with him for the better half of the last 2 years, including our host family in Portland, Maine. I know Mike really well. And we talk about, you know, we talk about baseball all the time, especially Big Ten baseball. And especially if the Hoosiers play the Terrapins. So he always likes to remind me of the 17 strikeout game he had in the Big Ten tournament, which was 2016. Yep. That was our senior year. Which was still one of the most amazing games I've seen pitched at any level. And he actually just got invited to big league camp, which is really, really a big honor for him and exciting for him, given the, you know, the status of our team and who he's going to get to learn from and be with. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with how well he's done, how high he was drafted, how much they like him as a player. So he's got a lot of opportunity ahead in this game. There's no doubt. He's a big, strong kid, and he will eat up innings until you physically take the ball from him, which is one of the things I respect about him to no end.
All right. So Kyle, we have one last question for you before we start wrapping it up. If you have time after this, I'm going to go back to the Kyler Murray thing. We can
do it.
That's on you. So the long-term impact of your 2014 Tommy John surgery was that we as fans were able to watch you lead the Hoosiers for two more seasons. Where you gave us some fantastic performances. But can you take us back to 2014? It was the best regular season in program history. You were sidelined by injury, like we talked about earlier. Just as you seemed to be hitting your stride and becoming dominant on the mound, and you had to watch the final game from the bench when Stanford's Tommy Edmond walked us off at the Bark. Can you reflect on that moment and what you were thinking?
So, you know, that's a very thoughtful question. It was a bit, I mean, it's just a bit of bad luck, honestly. I felt like throughout my youth baseball career and definitely into my college career that I had really worked on my mechanics to the point that they were very repeatable and I thought very safe in terms of, you know, being able to avoid injury and staying strong and staying on the field, because that to me at the end of the day is the most important, you know, factor in how relevant you are as a player. Yeah. I mean, you got to compete, you got to be productive, but you got to stay on the field. You got to be healthy. And I was doing extra stuff that other guys weren't doing in terms of, you know, some extra mobility in the weight room, extra stuff in the training room. And I still got hurt. And it just put the salt on the wound to have it happen when I was pitching so well. You know, I remember feeling the pain, and it was very delayed. Like, I would throw the ball and then feel the pain shoot up my arm after Schwarber threw the ball back to me. It was like a 4-second delay, 5-second delay, to the point that it was almost an afterthought to me. The only thing that scared me was I had no idea where it was going. And it was the fourth inning at Ohio State with two outs, and I threw three straight wild pitches, like 10 miles an hour slower than regular. And like I said, I was feeling that pain. I was like, I'm never going to get out of this inning. And on 3-0, I lobbed it in there, and the guy popped out. Which the funniest part of the whole injury to me, this is I didn't realize this until probably a good 2 or 3 years after the fact. So it was the fourth inning. I completed the fourth inning. We were winning like 2-1. In the top of the fifth inning, we scored like 5 or 6 runs to take a pretty substantial lead against Ohio State. And I finished my career one win behind Joey Donato in the Big Ten record books. And if I would have known my UCL was torn, I would have tried to finish that fifth inning of that game just to try to tie him, because I knew I was going to get this. If I knew I was going to get the surgery anyway, I could have at least got my name next to him in one thing. And if I could have just, if it could have just torn after the fifth inning and I would have got the win, I would have been so much happier. But no, I'm going to be second or probably lower than that, but I'm going to never be as good as Joey Donato in any category. So that's kind of the funny, that's the funny part for me. I tell a lot of people that. But in terms of just, you know, what it did for me mentally, it defeated me a little bit for a while. But fortunately, and I say fortunately, Halstead had gotten hurt, you know, prior to that. And just to have him going through something similar was so lucky for me, you know, obviously unlucky for him, unlucky for both of us, but to have each other throughout that process was so crucial, because, and obviously we were dealing with different things, but just the amount of time we had to spend on getting better was, you know, vast. And to have each other was just an amazing, amazing thing for both of us. I think he'll probably tell you the same thing. Because going through it alone, although everyone kind of has your back and your family's there, it just felt better. And, you know, I'd like to think that going down the stretch, we would have been able to contribute. I mean, I think a lot of people would tell you that we would have been able to. Now, I don't know what could – no one can predict the future. No one can predict an alternate universe or anything. Who knows? Me and Halstead could have lost us games down the stretch. We could have been in a completely different setting or not playing at all. But, you know, to see the Efros and the Kelsers and the Donatos and the Harrisons, all those guys – have to pick up all those extra innings that me and Halstead could have shouldered the weight. That's what bothered me. It was just like watching them have to do more than they should have had to. You know, not that Efros would have not been in the game against Tommy Edman, but he could have been fresher. You know, he could have had more time to rest. Maybe we could have brought in me or Halstead, you know, you never know, but that's what hurt, was just not being able to be out there and help. So I'm appreciative of the injury. I feel like it was a good thing for me with really bad timing. I wish, you know, there's never really a good timing for 12 months off of anything. But, you know, whether it's April or January or June, it's going to suck no matter what. You're going to miss time. So, you know, like I said, that was the hardest part, was just watching, you know, watching the guys compete as hard as they could and come up short, you know, knowing they gave everything they had and not being able to help them. Especially, you know, we're in that crazy stretch of just winning and winning and winning, and then you get hurt. And what happens when you get hurt really quick, I'll finish up, when you get hurt and people know this is a major injury or you have a surgery, people start to put you aside, which they have to do. I mean, there's no other way to do it, because if you don't want to become a distraction, right? So you kind of just stay off to the side. You don't get in the way. You're not really a part of any of the workouts or any of the meetings or anything like that, because you don't matter at that point. Now, everyone still cares about you, still has your back, still likes to be with you. But when it's like when you're talking to somebody and you can tell they have other things on their mind, they're looking right through you. That's kind of how it feels when you're hurt, because you have nothing to give to the team that's going to help them win the game. You have plenty to offer, but you don't have anything that's going to help them, you know, here and now. And you have to kind of overcome that, because that's just the nature of it. And that's what the team has to do to move forward. They have to continue to try to complete the task, to execute the game plan without you. Like I said, that's why it was so helpful to have Halstead, because we were just, you know, bouncing thoughts and ideas and experiences off of each other the whole time, instead of one of us going through it alone. You know, it was a testament to those guys to, you know, you lose your closer, one of the best pitchers in the Big Ten, and that was devastating enough. And then you get knocked back a starter who, at the very least, I feel like I was going to eat a lot of innings. And with that offense, I was probably going to be able to win some games. And then, not, you know, it's not even about the talent that you lose. It's about just how much more that the guys on the team have to pick up the slack. It just, you feel like dead weight. It's a crappy feeling, but you know, like I said, so proud of the guys for how they handled it and how they moved forward with really a chip on their shoulder in a league that was terrified of them. If that makes sense.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. I wish maybe you had been on the mound for that bat. Maybe that would have changed things, but like you said, you never know.
Who knows? He could have hit it 50 feet further. Yeah.
Things happen for a reason. So, do you want to, before we wrap up here, do you want to talk about the Kyler Murray situation?
Yeah, I got a minute. It looks like the Hoosiers lost tonight. That sucks. They lost by 15 in Assembly Hall. That is amazing.
I had it on delay, Kyle.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
We had a pre-meeting.
Oh, that's my great. God. I am so great. Sorry.
No, you're good, Kyle. You're the man. He was the only one who taped it.
You're good, man. Talk about Kyler Murray.
Well, I just saved you. I just saved you an hour and a half.
Yeah, you didn't want to watch the end of that, Josh. I've been watching.
I'm sorry about that. That's horrible. I should have known. I should have not. If I had logged into the chat earlier, you guys could have
told me.
So the thing about Kyler Murray that blows my mind right now is that, well, I mean, it's changed a little bit in the last few hours because he has declared for the NFL draft. But just what the MLB and what the Oakland Athletics were considering doing was just – It was mind blowing. It was literally blowing my mind, because you would have set a precedent for players coming forward that would have been requesting MLB contracts out of the gate almost. You know, you're basically bending the rules for one guy, but you know, you're bending them so much that you would have opened the door for future people. Not just necessarily. I'm not talking about Heisman winners, but super high picks that may have some sort of leverage in some way. I'm not, you know, entirely sure what situations could have arose in the future that would have necessarily paralleled this one, but you get what I'm saying. You just, it would have literally been game changing. And like I said, at first I thought 15 was a pretty good number for what he was trying to do, but I think his argument was he was trying to match what he potentially could get in the first round of the NFL draft, I guess. You know, Boris probably had some whole thing drawn up, but it was just amazing to me to see somebody that talented that can just leverage his situation that much. And then to ultimately choose football, I don't know what your guys' thoughts are, but I obviously don't have a problem with whatever he wants to do, he can do. And you can't blame him for it. I hope he gets what he's looking for in the NFL. And I'm sure in the back of his mind, he knows that he can just go Tim Tebow this whole thing if the NFL doesn't work out, and probably like not be labeled as a publicity stunt. You know, really, you know, not that Tim is. I've spoke to Tim several times. I don't think that's what he is at all. That's what a lot of people are claiming. So, yeah, I just thought it was really interesting. I mean, if you guys want to share your thoughts, that'd be awesome, because I would like to hear some other angles. I don't particularly know, you know, what the right thing to do or what would be best for him. I don't think anybody knows, but just crazy to me.
It would definitely would have been groundbreaking, because it was been like getting a $15 million signing bonus, basically.
Yeah, and which is twice of what happen? Anyone's got.
Right, and is that really going to happen, though, without the leverage? And I don't see this really coming up that much, because how many of these guys are there that really have NFL money sitting there on the table?
So no, yeah. Deion Sanders. Yeah. So far.
That's what I mean, though, is I can't specifically think of another situation where, unless you're a top athlete of another sport,
right?
You know, but I feel like there are other situations where somebody could sit back and go, "I'm not coming to play unless you give me more than what you said you were going to give me." I just feel like there are alternate, you know, situations that could come into play here. And I just feel like the MLB wanted to keep him so bad that they were trying everything, you know.
It definitely sounds like he's a huge talent. They wanted him, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I guess we'll just have to see if it comes up again what someone would choose. I personally am surprised he didn't just choose baseball, but that's
yeah.
up to him.
Yeah, I mean, what was his signing bonus? 4.5?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that yeah, you could manage $4.5 million the rest of your life, no problem. I mean, like that's the thing that I would be thinking about. But then again, you know, I'm not him, and I'm, you know, he's got the right to choose whatever he wants. And I'm sure there's a lot at play that we don't realize, which there always is in these situations. I'm sure there's some NFL teams that have contacted him in the early part of the first round saying, hey, if you turn away from baseball, we promise we'll take you. I'm sure there's something like that going on. So what's probably going to happen in my mind is he gets overdrafted. Because somebody's probably in his ear right now saying, we're going to take you, we're going to take you, turn away from baseball, turn away from baseball. That's what's in my mind. So I'm thinking, you know, not that he would get overdrafted if he went early in the first round. He's really talented, but I think a lot of people probably are projecting him middle to late first round just because of the height thing, which that's a whole nother podcast probably. But, you know, I've heard from some people that I work out with that played him in travel ball or whatever in baseball. And they said that he's very good. They said he's very good, but that he's a better football player, you know, and how can you argue with that? He's won the Heisman. He's the best in the country. So, I mean, obviously that's a pretty basic statement, but they're talking about pure talent wise, you know, awards and all that thrown out the window. He's a better football player from what I hear.
Well, Kyle, we kind of hit that time in the night, and I really just want to say thank you, man. I really appreciate your answers, the really thoughts you put into it. You really gave us a little view inside the life of the minor leaguer and the college ball player. And definitely, I've had a great time just doing this, and I'm sure it's going to be a great listen for everybody. So thanks again for that.
No, thank you guys all. I'm sorry that Carl got cut out. I hope it wasn't something that I did. I must have said something. Huh?
It wasn't. No.
It's probably some tech nonsense. But yeah. I gotta wrap this up. So that'll be it for this edition of Talking Hoosier Baseball. You can follow us, iubase.com, on @iubase17 on Twitter. And you can follow the podcast account, which is @CUAtTheBart on Twitter. One thing I forgot to mention at the top, our podcast is now on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. So hop over there, leave a review, give us a good rating or something. They have some algorithms that if people give good ratings, apparently it helps. So take care of us if you can. For Cassie, Josh, Carl, and Kyle, I'm Chris Feeney saying goodnight, and we'll see you at the BART.